The year 1965 is the 20th in the life of the United Nations. It is also being observed throughout the world as International Cooperation Year. As a contribution to the objectives of the ICY, United Nations Radio is presenting a series of special programs on the extent and nature of cooperation through international organizations. In this, the first program, the speaker is Alexander Scorby.
Programs, by ancient convention, must have titles. But why they can't just start without them, I'll never really know. So I've called this one, To Shake or to Strike. And so that it makes some sense, let me make a point. Thousands of years separate the caveman and the cosmonaut. And yet, however civilized we may have become, we have as a species managed to preserve one rather unflattering quality. Call it, if you like, mankind's psychomuscular syndrome. Apparent in the fact that the human hand, the arm, and the motor nerves directing them can be used in two different ways. They can be outstretched to shake another hand in friendly partnership, or they can strike a blow in arrogance, fear, and anger. If you've read any scary headlines lately, and who hasn't, this frequently dangerous ambivalence is all too clear. Indeed, it's been noted many times in many contexts. I remember, for example, a November afternoon 3 years ago in the General Assembly Hall at UN headquarters. Every delegation was seated to hear an address by the late Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru. People who knew him well have said that, like many thinkers, Nehru often produced his most valuable ideas more or less spontaneously, without formulating his thoughts too precisely in advance. And on that occasion, he did just that. He spoke of the quarrels and conflicts, the nagging fears and frustrations which then, as now, plagued the world. Then he changed his angle of vision. Let me play a tape of what he said.
I cannot suggest any rapid magic ways of dealing with the problems of the world, but I find that perhaps the worst difficulty we have to face is to fight something you cannot grip, an atmosphere, the imponderables of life, how people suddenly are filled with fear, passion, hatred. How can we deal with them?
Having thus noted the second of our psychomuscular reactions, Mr. Nehru found the answer to his question in the first.
We live in this world of conflicts, and yet the world goes on undoubtedly because of the cooperation of nations and individuals.
Then he began to develop his idea.
Little is known or little is said about this cooperation that is going on, but a great deal is said about every point of conflict. And so the world is full of this idea that the conflicts go on and we live on the verge of disaster. Perhaps a truer picture would be if the cooperating elements in the world today are put forward and make us think that the world depends on cooperation and not on conflict.
Well, the General Assembly agreed with him. The idea bore fruit in the designation of this International Cooperation Year. Without injecting you with the soporific details of how the idea was developed, let me simply say that the year is dedicated to the proposition that with an enlarged awareness of the already broad areas of cooperation, we may be more inclined to extend the range still further. A worthy aim, you feel? But a little flatulent? When he put forward the original idea, Nehru was quite prepared for such a reaction. There is, he said, nothing new or wonderful about the idea. But
there's nothing new or wonderful about the truths of the world. And the truth is that violence and hatred are bad for individuals, bad for everybody. And the great men of the world have been those who have fought hatred and violence, and not those who have encouraged it.
There's also nothing very new about the idea of cooperation. Goodness knows when it started. Probably some hairy, evil-smelling troglodyte one day persuaded a neighbor to help him shift some old bones out of the cave. and they decided to get together on some other urgent household chores. But whatever the starting point, the evolution of the practice of cooperation is well enough defined. Dag Hammarskjöld sketched its sociological history once in an address before the Chicago Law School.
Men organized themselves into families. The families joined together in villages or tribes. The tribes and the villages fused into peoples. And one day, out of the self-consciousness of a people, there develops a feeling of difference and separateness, the positive expression of which is a feeling of nationhood.
This, of course, is a long way from the end of the line. In fact, having reached that stage in our socio-political development, we found that our troubles were just beginning. Separateness became sacred, and the second of our psychomuscular reactions went to work. With slings and arrows and blunderbusses and bombs, everybody set out to prove that his own brand of separateness was the finest on the market. But once again, and at the same time, psychomuscular number one was also in the picture. In his Chicago speech, Hammarskjöld made this note of it.
Nation borders on nation. Peoples get in touch with each other, and whatever differences there may exist, whatever conflicts of interest the peoples may see, they are forced to live together.
This development was not always, of course, a mutually beneficial operation. In dealing with their neighbors, the empire builders, ancient and modern, more often than not worked on the strong-arm principle of cooperate or else. However, let's not spend too much time in the distant past. With the 19th century, the nations began to talk with rather than shout at each other. And this encouraging phenomenon was encouraged by the great technological upsurge which those years produced. In fact, it's in this combination of consultation and technology that you find the embryos of present-day international organizations. For example, at Brussels in 1853, there was an international conference called to discuss ways and means of collecting and codifying weather observations made by ships at sea. Its impact was probably slight in making life before the mast less hazardous, but during the next 25 years, there were more conferences at Leipzig, Vienna, Utrecht, and London. In 1878, this long labor produced a child, the International Meteorological Organization. It's still at work, though it changed its name to the World Meteorological Organization in 1947 when it became an agency of the UN. But even this respectable history doesn't make it the oldest of these agencies. It's more than 100 years since a newfangled gadget called the telegraph began speeding up long-distance communication. Speeding up is hardly the word, at least internationally. Although the wires were strung across frontiers, the authorities in each country had habits that made the sending of a telegram a pretty unreliable means of getting in touch. They'd hold up messages from outside while giving priority to their own. And over each national section of any given telegraph line, the rates varied so much that they were even more confusing than airline fares sometimes are today. There's a story which may or may not be true, that in 1865, a bank in London went bankrupt. The distressed directors wired the sad news to their branch manager in Bombay. Unfortunately, the message wasn't delivered for 10 days, during which time the distant tellers were still merrily cashing checks. Realizing that it would be helpful if there was some order and cohesion in the business, the nations got together and came up with the International Telegraph Convention, done at Paris, May 17th, 1865. This year, the outgrowth of that convention, the International Telecommunications Union, with responsibilities not only on Earth but in space, is celebrating its 100th birthday. And that, rather sketchily, brings the story into the 20th century. With the astonishing advances in communication and transport that these years have seen, The opportunities for closer and closer cooperation between peoples, as well as for greater and greater conflicts, have kept in step. But as Nehru observed, it is cooperation and not conflict that has kept the world turning. I hope the many hundreds of professional and private associations with international ramifications, the non-governmental organizations, as they are called in the UN lexicon, will not be offended if I say no more than that they have multiplied prodigiously in the last 60 years. The fact that most are little known outside their particular fields, in science, medicine, education, law, the arts, and so on, does not detract from their value as channels for cooperation or from their significance as evidence of the growing worldwide awareness of interdependence. I'll just stick to the 20th century development of international governmental organizations, with its two major signposts, the foundation of the League of Nations in 1919 and of the United Nations in 1945. U Thant, the Secretary General of the UN, has spoken about the two organizations, their similarities and their differences. I'd like to play a little of what he said.
Both organizations were designed as an intermediate base between the international relations of traditional diplomacy, which had become obsolescent with the disasters of the First World War and were proved inadequate and even dangerous with the Second World War and the theoretical ultimate aim of a world legislature, if not a world government. Both organizations, therefore, show the weaknesses of a transitional state. Great aims with small means. Great responsibilities with little authority. Great expectations clouded by deep suspicions. And hopes for the future constantly blurred by fears and prejudices from the past.
I remember Dag Hammarskjöld calling this transitional period, with all its precarious features, the institutional phase in the evolution of a world society. The next phase, of course, and nobody can yet predict when we'll be in it, is the constitutional phase, when we'll have a world at peace under law and international cooperation will be as richly rewarding as it is already in more restricted areas. But how are we moving along? I'll leave the answer to Mr. Thant.
We are now moving away quickly from the wall of compartmentalized self-sufficiency into a world where human solidarity daily becomes more essential. Already in humanitarian questions, this solidarity is real, as we can see from international responses to natural and other disasters. It is becoming more real in the economic field, and it is clearly a necessity, though not yet a practical reality, in the political field. Here the governments of the world associated in the United Nations must realize the ideals which were already accepted in 1919 in the Covenant of the League of Nations and were reaffirmed in 1945 in the Charter of the United Nations.
Well, we've been a little general, a little too philosophic perhaps, in this first program of the series. But I can promise you some good flesh and bones in later editions. And I think you'll find the story of international cooperation as it already exists an exciting one.
Alexander Scorby has just introduced a special series of programs from United Nations Radio produced in recognition of 1965, International Cooperation Year.